From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Our question of the day, late night punchline. Has Howard Dean become a joke? Want to know what you think? Send us an email. The question at MSNBC.com. You can vote online and you can see the results.
If there's any lesson we take away from Iowa, it's that the media love a winner and love to hate a loser. And according to National Journal media critic Bill Powers, the theatrical coverage of the rise and fall of candidates follows the same predictable stages as celebrity tales of triumph over adversity. He calls it the Hollywood Washington paradigm and says it was at work during the caucus coverage.
This is the classic downfall of the star. This happens with Hollywood stars, too, where they're risen up to this sort of level of perfection, and then something happens. In the case of Hollywood stars, it would be often in their personal lives, or it would be a flop, a movie flop. In the case of these politicians, it's, of course, a result at the polls. So this happened, obviously, with Dean. We had this long run-up of adulatory coverage, and, of course, you know, there were people asking questions along the way, too, and exceptions, but the general tenor of it was, this is the man. You know, this guy's on fire. And the perfect result, once that reaches a certain level, is at the last minute for there to be a kind of a plot reversal, as there is in any good screenplay. And there's this incredible drama, and we even had that wonderful added bonus of the strange Dean Howell, which added to the theater and served our purposes beautifully.
Yes, the strange Dean Howell. More on that later, by the way. Well, let me ask you this. It's very easy to kind of pull back a little and look at the media's behavior and ridicule it for being predictable or a cliché or whatever. But is this process that you're describing necessarily some sort of evil in the way the press covers things?
No, and I don't mean to suggest that. I think it's a very human process. I think it reflects who we are as people and how we come at the world. I do think that the one element of it that is troubling is that the media, the folks who are paid to sort of step back from it all and ask questions about the process, tend to be as caught up in it and in the moment and in this tiny day-by-day frame as any typical person coming in would be. You would hope that these folks of experience and training and so forth would be asking the kinds of questions more often that I think need to be asked, which is, you know, if we see this person hot right now, are they going to be necessarily hot 6 months from now? Some people do that. But I think the general tenor of the coverage is this breathless, what's happening today is the reality, and please pay attention to it. And also the notion that we need to pay this much attention to it. I mean, the play that these primaries are given, I really question.
Well, the phenomenon you've just described would explain why John Kerry, who was given up for dead by a lot of the media as recently as 7 days ago, was the de facto Democratic response to the president's State of the Union address. He was on all three major networks from some remote location in New Hampshire, where he got to deliver what amounted to his stump speech.
And in a way, you know, Kerry is right out of central casting for this purpose, because we in the media have been contending with Dean all this time, who's not a Washington figure, somebody who doesn't fit into any particular category, whereas Kerry is somebody that we sort of feel we know. He's sort of the classic senator type. And so to have him swoop in there just before the State of the Union and then be the guy who comes on afterwards, it was really perfect. It was as if our own paradigm had fulfilled itself.
Are there any other examples, Bill, of what we saw in the post-caucuses coverage that is evidence that these patterns really exist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm looking at the front page right now of one of Washington's fine newspapers. The headline is, Kerry surges past Dean in poll. And we have a huge picture of John Kerry, yes, kissing a baby. I mean, it is these archetypal, it's there, I'm looking at it, it's the Washington Times. It is these archetypal patterns that we come back to again and again, and they are basically plot elements. It has a kabuki quality to it sometimes, very ritualistic, but it's what we've got.
I want to talk about the Hollywood comparison you made, because it seems to me that one of the candidates very much fills that bill, and that's, as you predicted, those 18 months ago, John Edwards. He pulled a total John Travolta. Tell me about that.
Travolta had this wonderful rise in the 70s, Saturday Night Fever, and he was this fabulous movie star who'd come out of television, of course. And then he had this incredible flop, a movie called Moment to Moment that I believe he did with Lily Tomlin. And it really knocked him out of the park for quite a while. Wasn't taken seriously. I believe he had a hard time getting roles and so forth. And then years later, Quentin Tarantino brought him back, and there was this fabulous comeback of Travolta. And I see Edwards doing that over and over again in the political realm in much the same way.
So what was John Edwards' moment to moment?
John Edwards' moment to moment was initially when he first sort of came onto the radar screen as a presidential possibility was his appearance on the Tim Russert show. It would have been 2 years ago now, actually, going way back. And he was, after all our hopes had been raised and we'd fallen in love with this wonderful new face who we thought would live in the White House one day and so forth, we the media, that is, he appears on Tim Russert's show, which is this real kind of rite of passage you have to go through, and he flopped in the view of the media establishment. He put in a horrible performance, seemed completely unprepared, couldn't answer various tough questions, and that was it. It seemed, as with John Travolta in the moment-to-moment period, it seemed as if he had no future in this business. But of course, now we know he did.
So let's just say that the Iowa caucuses, and where he came a strong second to John Kerry, are his Pulp Fiction. But then that leaves open the possibility that there's some Scientologist flick in his immediate future, maybe in New Hampshire?
Absolutely. I forget the name of that movie that was the latest Travolta fall. But Bob, I want to say that since he came in second, he, from the point of view of the Edwards camp, I think is in this wonderful position where he can still portray himself as on the rise because he wasn't number one. John Kerry's the one who is now set up for the fall, as we all know.
All right, Bill. Well, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Bill Powers covers media for the National Journal.
Senator Kerry, Governor Dean has said of you, and I believe also of Senator Edwards, that you cast votes that you knew were wrong on the war for political reasons. How do you answer that charge?
Well, I stood up to the people of Massachusetts and the country. Those are the people I answer to. And I answer by saying that there was a right way to hold Saddam Hussein accountable, and there was a wrong way. The right way was what the president promised, to go to the United Nations.
After Thursday's debate wrapped up, the weary candidates exited stage right and went not home to bed, but on to the spin room. There, the reporters asked the questions that didn't get asked in the debate, and the candidates reiterated their messages. New Hampshire Public Radio's Raquel Maria Dillon sent us this postcard from backstage after a debate last month in Durham, New Hampshire.
It's stuffy and close, so crowded you can't even move sometimes. There are pushy cameramen, swinging boom mics, and wayward cables to trip over.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
I'm caught on you. Sorry. Thank you. Excuse me.
The candidates stroll in, still wearing their TV makeup. Some of them look like they just got up from their tanning beds. John Kerry pops in for a couple quick television interviews and takes off. Kerry's New Hampshire deputy campaign director, Judy Reardon, says her candidate doesn't usually work the spin room. It's his strategy to let his debate performance speak for itself. But she wouldn't miss the chance to spin.
It's fun. I don't know if it does any good, but it's fun. It's a chance for everybody to see each other after a debate. There's a lot of tension building up before a debate, and you're tense while you're watching it, and then you come to this room and all the campaigns are here and all the press are here, and it's sort of a little fun circus atmosphere.
Hi, Judy.
Across the room, reporters mob Howard Dean as soon as he sets foot in the spin room.
Excuse me.
But I can't even get near him. I can't get past this wall of backs. I consider crawling on my hands and knees through the forest of legs, but first I ask for some advice from Scott McKay, veteran political reporter for the Providence Journal.
Probably would help if you were a linebacker, maybe in college, and you were a big guy. You know, you notice the network tech guys have sharp elbows. That really helps. Some time in the weight room. What it takes is a good shoving technique.
We reporters are pushing, literally, for insightful comments or new information that shed light on the debate. But McKay says that's not likely.
Obviously, there's so many people here that you don't get anything original, and it's pretty scripted. It's untidy. It's like the rest of the democratic process. It's American democracy. It's a sprawling kind of crazy thing, and this is the way we do it. I'm not sure it's the right way, but it's the way we do it.
He's been into our classes already, right?
My name is David Swanson. I'm the campaign press secretary for Dennis Kucinich for president.
Swanson has one of the toughest jobs in the room, getting the national political reporters to pay attention to his underdog candidate.
The congressman did such a tremendous job in the debate and really led the discussion and drew the strongest contrast and did the best job of focusing the debate on important issues.
Everyone says that about their candidate, according to New Hampshire Democratic Party Chair Kathy Sullivan.
Basically, everybody in here is trying to tell you what they think happened at the debate or what they wished happened at the debate, or sort of like the platonic vision of the debate as seen through the, you know, shadows on the cave. So it really, this doesn't have a lot of bearing on reality.
I guess that's why they call it the spin room.
It's pretty hot in here, isn't it?
Oh, it's really hot. Oh, man, it's hot.
By this time, we're all melting in our winter sweaters. Meanwhile, John Edwards' New Hampshire press secretary, Colin Van Ostern, is trying to lure reporters out into the cold to a nearby bar where his candidate is giving an impromptu stump speech.
You know, rather than have him in here in a room talking to a lot of people that might as well be in Washington right now, he's out there talking to real New Hampshire voters.
Hey, guys.
Mr. Chairman,
you got a minute? John Edwards is holding a town hall meeting at the bar across the street right now. If you want to hear real questions, real voters.
Okay.
I'm
saying
have anybody.
Got a real voter right here.
Hey,
free beers?
I will buy you beer.
Yes.
Right now.
Where?
But I'm staying here in the spin room, schmoozing with a fellow public radio reporter, Sean Carberry from WBUR. He understands my pain.
It is tough. I mean, we're lower down the food chain. I mean, the TV cameras get the first attention, especially ones with network logos and all that. Just hang out, because eventually the big fish drop away, and you're standing there with the candidate and have your chance to grab them. It's a war of attrition, ultimately. But it's organized chaos. I mean, it is herding cats, ultimately. It's a dogfight. It's also fun.
Except that now I have to find my coat, warm up my car, because it's 14 degrees plus wind chill outside, drive an hour back to the station, and write my story. This is the glamour of political reporting. For On the Media, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon in Concord, New Hampshire.
Did you have trouble with the Confederate battle flag statement?
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Coming up, bloggers blogging the reporters reporting on the campaign trail, and the whoop heard round the world.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. These are tough times for campaign scribes, and tough times call for tough love, now gushing forth like an uncapped fire hydrant from the web. In fact, some concerned citizens have volunteered their time to, in their words, adopt a journalist. The idea took off after web blogger Steve Gilliard saw one blogger doing just that. Gilliard wrote, "I think it would be a really, really good idea to track reporters word for word, broadcast for broadcast, and print the results online." He wrote, "It's all inside baseball to them, who's up and who's down. The cool kids club is pissing away our democracy like drunks at a strip club handing out $1 bills." And he concluded, "Well, that's a luxury that we can no longer afford. If they will no longer do their job on their own, it's time to make them."
It's a combination of a little bit embarrassing and a little bit flattering, frankly. I mean, you know.
Jody Wilgerin is the New York Times reporter following the Dean campaign. She's been adopted by Dean supporter Tim Withers. And since December 23rd, her every word has been parsed on a blog called Wilgerin Watch.
I get a lot of letters from a number of passionate Dean supporters who don't like what I write, but I'm not sure if that's because they don't like what I write or they don't like what's going on.
On Wednesday, Wilgerin Watch slammed the reporter for her word choices after the Iowa caucus. Tim Withers.
"As we read through the piece, we see Miss Wilgerin's thesaurus was working overtime. How many variations on the angry theme can we find? The article is sprinkled with mentions of the outsider's tirade, the scowl of outrage, a growling and defiant Iowa concession speech. I'm not necessarily criticizing Miss Wilgerin's references to Monday night speech, although one or two variations would probably have sufficed. He kind of asked for it. But I question why Governor Dean's version of why he was so animated was buried near the end of the piece."
What motivated you to start Wilgerin Watch?
"I was concerned with some of the coverage I was seeing, especially in the New York Times. I wasn't really sure that it was very balanced and fair to the governor."
As a Dean supporter, do you think you're in a position to know what's balanced and fair?
"I have tried very hard not to be too critical. I've tried not to be too snarky when I evaluated the piece. So no, of course, I'm not completely objective. And I know no journalist can be completely objective. But I think there's also a line that sometimes has been crossed in the Times coverage."
People who are passionate believers in a particular truth are not really the greatest judges of fairness in newspaper stories.
Jody Wilgerin.
You know, because the version of the truth that I'm working on is not a truth that assumes that Dean is a great candidate or that Dean should become president. You know, and I understand that there are people for whom that is truth.
Journalists are perhaps accustomed to discounting those who have a stake because they expect that nothing but spin, propaganda, bias can come from such a person. But I don't necessarily think that's true.
New York University professor, media critic, and blogger Jay Rosen.
This is a citizen activity, and people are motivated to do things as citizens because they do have a stake. But people who have a stake have to learn that this doesn't absent them from a responsibility to public truth. And that's one of the deeper lessons that might come an individual weblogger's way.
But these new, largely partisan, adopted journalist blogs vary widely in quality. Some are so raw, it could be argued that Rosen's deeper lesson has yet to penetrate. That's why Rosen both loves and dreads this exercise in citizen participation. He loves the idea of readers holding reporters to account. He loves the education it offers them both. But
I dread it because there's a lot of free-floating hate for the media out there. And the origins of this adopt-a-reporter idea were in not just frustration, but in some cases animus towards the media, but also towards individual journalists. And the worst thing, of course, is that hate distorts what you see in front of your eyes.
So, if you don't trust partisans to monitor campaign reporters, how about other reporters?
I don't want to say that every blog out there is put together by a 14-year-old kid in the basement. I mean, there's some very solid ones. I haven't found one that devotes itself exclusively to campaign press criticism and commentary, and that's staffed by professionals who are articulate, analytical, and fast.
That's what Steve Lovelady, a former managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer and current managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review's CampaignDesk.org, says he has to offer. And not a moment too soon. Every election cycle, the process for picking a president becomes more and more front-loaded. As it currently stands, 10% of all convention delegates will be picked by January 28th and 60% by March 3rd. As a result, reporters rush to set unreasonable expectations for candidates, exult when they meet them, and reach for the shovels when they fail. Campaign Desk calls reporters not just on bias and inaccuracy, but on their tendency to bury candidates alive.
Reporters pick arbitrary yardsticks. That permits the reporter to come back 24 hours later and say, candidate X flunked yardstick Y. Well, yardstick Y is a creation of the reporter himself. We're there to say this isn't productive for the undecided voter or reader to have this steady flurry of stories which essentially consist of a dog chasing its own tail.
So then, with reporters now beating up on other reporters, there may be nothing for it but for them to stand up and take their lumps. And in the end, that could actually improve their relationship with their frustrated audience. Jay Rosen.
I think it's frustration with a big institution that has the power to define reality to some degree. And I think there's a lot of distortion in the news media, but there's a lot of distortion of the news media in the culture of complaint that we have created around it.
You know, back in my day when I was growing up, that used to be the phone company.
Yes, well, I think that the news media has in some ways become this gigantic object with the power to define what's real, whether you like it or not, just like Lily Tomlin used to joke about the phone company. We're the phone company. We don't have to care.
Now, with this burgeoning brigade of online watchdogs, the media have a new and pressing reason to care.
Here's a nice little song you might enjoy.
And Washington, and Oregon, and Washington, we're going to South Dakota, we're going to South Dakota, and Michigan, yeah!
That's from blogger James Lilick, who was by no means alone this week in fixating on Howard Dean's arm-pumping, phlegm-churning, state-naming pep rally from hell.
Washington, D.C. to take back the White House! Yeah!
The outburst has been described as demonic, but that's not quite right. It was more like a spasm of what Alan Greenspan would call irrational exuberance, performed in the key of yelp, half Comanche battle cry, half getting your hand caught in the garbage disposal. It also bore a striking resemblance to another famous whoop, the movie scream sound effect called the Wilhelm, which, as we've explored on this show, has been spliced into dozens of movies since its debut in a 1953 Western. The Wilhelm? Governor Howard Dean. We report, you decide. Now, it just so happens that I have no life, and at 3 a.m. was watching the Dean event in context in real time. My first impulse was to be impressed, because the churlish Dr. Know-It-All was showing some signs of life for his assembled faithful, and spontaneity, and humility, and leadership. If you're a Russian general at the Battle of Austerlitz and Napoleon is about to chase you back to Moscow, it's probably a pretty good time to rally the troops. Then the media began cutting tape. Within minutes of the live rally, broadcast audiences began witnessing the yelp, not in context and in real time, but excerpted for maximum cruelty and endlessly rerun. And what they saw was a man with a media-proliferated reputation for emotional instability becoming entirely unhinged before their eyes. It was one of those defining, destructive TV images, like Nixon sweating, Muskie crying, Paul Tsongas in a Speedo, and Michael Dukakis in a tank. Actually, never mind the Battle of Austerlitz. USA Today, among others, made Dean the Little Napoleon and Iowa his Waterloo. At least the actual Napoleon faced only exile and didn't have to watch the battle replayed on primetime Thursday four times. In that humiliating exercise in damage control, Dean sat with a clenched death grin and explained the circumstances of the moment, the morale building of 3,500 disappointed volunteers.
Do I do things that are a little nutty? Sure, I do things that are a little nutty.
Note the excerpt I chose. An out-of-context image, of course, like an out-of-context quote, can entirely misrepresent the larger reality. But it can also transcend context to become its own reality. Because the American public is willing to accept a great deal from a presidential candidate, including demagoguery, hypocrisy, and deceit. Nutty, however, does not scan. When the TV audience becomes an eyewitness to ridiculousness, history has shown presidential aspirations tend to die a shrieking death.
And now for a few of your letters. Mark Kometsko from Cleveland Heights, Ohio, wrote, I enjoyed your story on embedded campaign reporters and was glad to see that you raised the issue of a journalist's potentially losing his or her objectivity when so wedded to a single candidate. The same thing bothered me over the last two election cycles when NPR assigned one reporter each to the two main candidates and then allowed the winner to go on to become the White House reporter. Tying a reporter's professional success to helping sell the electability of his or her news object sends the wrong signal. NPR and other media who follow this trend ought not to reward reporters in this way.
Stephen J. Werson from Ridgecrest, California, complained about author Peter Biskin's comments about the movie Cold Mountain. Werson wrote, he said that this film is essentially about a man walking through the woods. Your critic may be an authority on independent films, but you should send him back to school to read the great books. Cold Mountain is a lot more than a man walking through the woods. It is a retelling of The Odyssey. Tell your critic to borrow a copy of The Odyssey and take it on a walk in the woods.
And finally, this from a listener who signs off as Mary Lou. She writes, who handles the media feed for the State of the Union? I felt a distinct Republican bias in the feed. I was wanting to see long shots of the whole chamber's reactions to the speech, when instead I received many close-ups of applauding Republicans, and I began to wonder who was making those choices for us.
Well, more on that in a second, but first I want to remind you to send your emails to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Your whole name, Mary Lou.
Now, back to the camera angles on this week's State of the Union address. It offered the usual views of a divided chamber, showing partisan enthusiasm.
Key provisions of the Patriot Act are set to expire next year. The terrorist threat... the terrorist threat will not expire on that schedule.
The camera work also included well-timed cuts to the usual suspects on key issues, like the glimpse of a disdainful Senator Kennedy when the president cited his commitment to prescription drug coverage. There was, as always, the general sense that the people behind the cameras were operating with a copy of the speech, a seating chart, and a game plan. But who makes the plan? As we heard, at least one listener suggests that some of the camera work seemed politically biased. Well, it turns out that the job of producing this annual piece of political theater works on a rotation basis among the networks. This year, ABC drew the short straw, and Peter Daugherty was the producer in charge. Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
How far ahead of time do you get the speech, and how much time do you have to actually plan your shots?
Well, not very much. The White House typically releases a speech within an hour before the actual airtime. So you scramble in that last hour to see if at various points in the text you can find what we call in the business a cutaway shot or a relief shot of somebody who has some relationship to the issue being discussed by the president.
So the cameraman is actually following a script then, however hastily written, for where he should direct the camera when.
Not exactly a script. What we do is I sit down with the pool director, in this case Larry Kam, who is one of the best in the business, and we make a couple of quick one-word or two-word notes to ourselves that at this point in the speech might be a good time to try for any one of three or four people. And part of the issue is, can the cameras actually see them? And one of the things that was disappointing this year was there was a section in the speech on Afghanistan, and one of our cameramen had happened to locate the Afghani diplomatic representative, and we sort of marked mentally in our minds, okay, we know he's over there, and camera so-and-so has him. And when the time came in the speech, the director said, hey, Hank Disselkamp was the cameraman, hey, Hank, go get the Afghani diplomatic representative. And Hank shook his camera back and forth, indicating no. Hank couldn't talk back because he was on the floor. So it took Larry a second to realize, oh, Hank, did he move? And then Hank shook his camera in the affirmative. Now, this is not on the air. This is a shorthand that the cameraman uses to the director. And sure enough, apparently what had happened is that after they were seated, either he or the State Department liaison realized there was a better seat and they gave it to him.
This is like herding cats, isn't it?
It's more like trying to find the right cat in a crowd of 550 or 60 cats.
Okay, what happens when you focus on the wrong cat? Like when you cut to the New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady when the president mentioned steroid abuse. The NFL has strict rules against steroid use, and that close-up has apparently provoked an angry response from the NFL.
We weren't trying to particularly tie him to the steroid issue. In fact, I must tell you, it's very busy in the truck, and sometimes when you're glancing from one monitor to another, you're never quite sure exactly what's on the line unless you're staring right at it. In that section of the speech, the president was talking about the relationship of athletes and sports heroes to youth. The administration had invited him, and we thought, gee, this is an appropriate time to show him. And one of the things I tried very hard to do is to make sure that we try to strike a balance. For example, during the speech, we showed not only the loyal opposition, but we also showed a number of Republican leaders and the administration people. We showed military people. We showed a lot of the people that were in the First Lady's gallery who had been brought because they had a stake in a certain part of the speech.
I take your point about what you're trying to do, but do you ever have anybody in there who's a little waggish, who's scanning the audience for the sleeping senator, the glazed eyes of a military officer? I mean, because otherwise you're basically just illustrating the president's speech. And there is a dynamic going on that is other than merely what the president's script wants you to see.
Our mission, I believe, is to show the audience as much as you can of what is going on in the room. We showed Senator Kennedy a couple of times. Right as we took him, I think the last time we put him up, he started sort of rubbing his fingers down his chin, almost in a gesture of ill will, but really not. If you looked at it, you could see that he was just sort of scratching his face. And when it happened, I immediately said on the conference call that I have to the pool members, we didn't plan that, folks. That's just what he started doing the minute we took that shot. We had a shot of Congressman Rangel, and somebody said to me, gee, he looked like he was asleep. And I said, no, many members have in their hands a copy of the speech. And I didn't have a wide enough shot to show he was looking down at his speech.
So this is an instance, as with the NFL quarterback, when bad camera timing happens to good people.
I really would say that. None of this is a deliberate effort. Frankly, people who think that are giving us far too much planning credit. This broadcast is live. It's happening very quickly. We couldn't pull these things off on purpose if we tried. If, for example, the Democrats are not clapping and we document that, it's to document it. It's not because we're trying to drive the point home. It's what's happening in the chamber.
Well, Peter, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
ABC producer Peter Daugherty produced the broadcast of the State of the Union speech that we all saw on Tuesday.
Coming up, the ever-shifting sands of the Iraqi media and a gaggle of war reporters gets confessional.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You may consider children's literature to be a simple matter of rhyming couplets and fluffy bunnies. But under Saddam Hussein, the stories and illustrations found in kids' books spoke to the kind of world Iraqi children were being raised to live in. On its website recently, the Institute for War and Peace Reporting in Baghdad reported that titles like Tanks in the Night that were offered pre-occupation are now giving way to children's magazines like Trumpet, which focus on games and comics and, yes, fluffy bunnies. Hiwa Osman, editor and trainer for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, worked with reporter trainee Salam Jihad on the story. Osman joins me now on the phone from Baghdad. Hiwa, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Tell me, please, what was children's literature like in Iraq before the war?
Well, it was heavily loaded with Saddam's pictures, Saddam's sayings, his quotes. I spoke to some small children who said that they had to memorize 100 quotes from leader president Saddam Hussein. Mathematics book had a picture of Saddam Hussein, and students were asked to measure the area of that picture. Saddam was all over the place.
I read about a story called Men of Our Country, which showed little Iraqi kids pictures of Iraqi military officers standing over a group of very miserable Iranian prisoners from the war with Iran in the 80s. Is that true?
It is indeed. This was basically part of the propaganda campaign by the old regime. All the children grew up with the notion that the Iranians hate us, the Syrians hate us, everybody. They basically wanted to prepare all the children for all the various wars that Saddam was doing against his neighbors.
What was the effect over the years of this kind of propaganda in children's literature?
Well, they lived in a complete state of isolation. Many of our trainees are recent graduates, so we can see the effect of that campaign, of that strategy against them. They are extremely frightened of everything that comes from outside. They're very militant as well, but with the little contact that they are having now with the outside world, for example, an institute like ours, or now they have satellite TVs or internet access to the outside world, they are seeing that life is not all about guns and tanks and wars and battles and leader president. There is a much brighter side to life, and only now they're dabbling with their first experiences with the outside life.
The story on your website focused on a publisher called Children's Culture House, which I gather publishes both books and magazines aimed at kids?
That's right.
Tell me, what's Children's Culture House publishing now?
Saddam Hussein's regime forced them to publish everything into the service of the great battle, as they described it. But nowadays, they are publishing a lot more stronger stories for children that might have a political undertone, that might have an educational undertone. Basically, it's acting as an important instrument in bringing the Iraqi children back to normal life.
So it's kittens and zoo animals and Tales of the Arabian Nights?
Tales of the Arabian Nights, tales from the Iraqi culture, and at the same time, stories of, for example, how was the Red Cross founded. But again, it's introducing them to various things that for years all the Iraqi people, not only children, were deprived of.
Are the authorities, the coalition authorities, now resisting the temptation to use this children's publishing house to do propaganda as well, to introduce democratic ideals and the glories of the West to Iraqi children, or is it completely hands-off?
I think it's completely hands-off. The authorities in Iraq today, I think they have enough on their plate to go into schools' books or children's literature. Basically, what they are finding, and this is what we have found as well in our institute, just let them be, and this is the natural path that they will take. They will want to learn about democracy. They would want to learn about new international norms and standards. We haven't heard of any cases of authorities trying to interfere with them.
Well, Hiwa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hiwa Osman is an editor and trainer for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He spoke to us from Baghdad, where one of his trainees wrote a story about changes in children's literature.
This month, the Pentagon awarded a Florida-based communications equipment company, Harris Corp., $96 million to run the much-criticized Iraqi media network. Harris Corp.'s partners on this enterprise will be two Arab media outlets, Al-Fawaris, a Kuwaiti company, and Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation International, or LBCI. The LBCI is charged with bringing Iraqis' radio and TV stations up to speed, overseeing programming and training journalists. Michael Young, opinion editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon, joins me on the line now from Beirut. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So, did it surprise you to learn that a Lebanese company, and particularly this company, would be America's choice to revamp Iraqi broadcast media?
Well, it didn't surprise me that a Lebanese company, especially LBCI, would be selected because it has a great deal of experience in television, both in Lebanon and the region. What was maybe a bit more surprising was the fact that a Lebanese company would participate in what is effectively an Iraqi reconstruction project. And given the fact that Syria, which is basically the main power broker in Lebanon, is not really in tune, if you will, with Iraqi reconstruction, the fact that a Lebanese company should have been involved was a bit surprising.
Do you think it's unusual in the region for a media company to run against the political wind?
Well, I think that we shouldn't overstate the fact that, yes, of course, the political systems in the region are usually fairly restrictive, but the Middle East media market is a very interesting exception to this. In other words, what you have is a situation where essentially market forces have kicked in to a certain extent, open up the media market. I mean, Al Jazeera, for example, everyone knows about Al Jazeera, but Al Jazeera is not alone. I mean, you have stations like Al Arabiya, you have even Abu Dhabi Television, the LBCI. These are all stations which in some way have challenged the frozen media of the past. And part of the reason for that is that you have competition. It's a competitive media market, and frankly, the Arab publics are not interested in seeing official stations which basically tell them nothing.
Given your experience in the region and the long time you've watched the evolution of media there, do you think that LBCI was a good choice by the Americans to start revamping Iraqi broadcast media?
Well, I think that certainly in terms of professionalism, it was a good choice. It's a station that has experience both in entertainment and news. This is something that you don't see with some of its competitors. For example, Al Jazeera is known more as a news channel when it comes to entertainment. Well, it's pretty dreadful. But that's, of course, going to be very important. I think that the anchor persons are very professional on LBCI. And my understanding is that professionalism is what the station will be essentially trying to train the Iraqis in.
Who owns the Lebanese broadcast company? Who determines what's on it? Aren't most of the media in Lebanon owned or at least backed by politicians?
Yes, that's right. I mean, LBCI, I don't have before me the breakdown of shares, but certainly it is owned by some politicians. As to your wider question, yes, indeed, the Lebanese media is owned and backed by politicians. But what you have is a curious situation of it's a balance of power. In other words, different influential politicians have stakes in different media, so that you always have a certain amount of competition between these, a certain amount of rivalry, which is actually very interesting from a media perspective, because it means you get more information out. Now, obviously, Syria has a say in what many stations put on the air in terms of political programming. But there is a paradox here. To a certain extent, it's almost a benign control. In other words, you often find on Lebanese television people you would never expect to be invited on an Arabic television show, including neoconservatives from the United States. So it's a mixed bag.
Let's move this then to Iraq. It seems to me that LBCI has a hard row to hoe because the Iraqi media network, the original American effort there to rebuild Saddam's media, was met with a great deal of disdain. I wonder whether they can get past the coalition's predisposition to good news and selective news and actually give the Iraqi people what they want.
I think that the bottom line is you want people to watch this media, and they do have a choice. That's what's interesting today. Is you turn on your television set, you don't have to watch the official media in any country. And even in Iraq, despite the difficulties, people do have satellite link-ups. So I do think that, you know, you cannot play this game the way you could 30 years ago. If they don't appeal to the Iraqi public, well, then people will watch other television stations.
All right. Thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you.
Michael Young is opinion editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon.
Last week in Atlanta, a group of five journalists with very different backgrounds gathered for a discussion on war reporting. Among them were two who covered the war in Iraq, a CBS News veteran who covered World War II and Vietnam, a senior executive from CNN, and the producer of a new documentary about war coverage. They talked about how much government interference and a journalist's own allegiances influence the reporting we see. Journalist Joshua Leves moderated the discussion and filed this report.
The event was organized by the Atlanta Press Club in connection with the premiere of Reporters at War, a four-part documentary airing on the Discovery Times channel. Before starting our discussion, we watched the final installment. It ends with several highly regarded British journalists complaining that news outlets, particularly TV networks, don't show images of civilians and soldiers brutally killed or maimed.
It should be on the air. And the reason the authorities in television, the reason governments think is, oh, you can't, but this is obscene, we must respect the dead. We don't want to respect the dead, we kill them. What we want to do is to stop people seeing these images, because if they saw them, they would never, ever again support war. And we want a population that will, when we want, support wars.
Real war has never been shown on television, and never will be.
You get the impression it's highly spectacular, like a grand video game, and that war is a cost-free way of settling differences. This is terribly dangerous and fundamentally untrue.
John Blair, who produced the documentary, told the audience at an auditorium in Midtown Atlanta that he had looked for some of the more horrific shots from the first Gulf War and ultimately found just two that had been mostly in the print media. One shows the charred body of an Iraqi soldier, the other a charred skull. He put both images in his documentary and hoped his editors would not take them out.
I waited with bated breath, because I wasn't part of their editing process here, as to whether they'd kept it in. And I'm pleased to say they did.
I think the impression which is being given that people like me sit in dark cutting rooms saying, out, 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 in, out, and oh my God, you couldn't possibly out, out, out. I'm afraid life's not like that.
Panelist Chris Kramer, managing director of CNN International.
The fact of the matter is that public tastes change over the years. It is different to cover a war which is being prosecuted by your own nation whether you like it or you don't. That's a fact of war. I've seen the images you refer to. I was at the BBC when they were taken. I'm not ashamed to say to you that I was one of the people who took it out at the time. They were completely disgusting, and I would not have shown those in the middle of a war prosecuted by a nation that I was working for at the time.
The relationship between a reporter and the government launching a war came under new scrutiny when the Pentagon embedded journalists with U.S. military units in Iraq. Ron Martz with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was one of them. Speaking on the panel, he said he reported whatever he saw and thought was relevant, with two exceptions laid out by his company commander.
Don't tell them where we are and don't tell them where we're going, because it's going to compromise their mission. It's going to compromise what we're trying to do. And if we do put them in danger, to a certain extent, we're putting ourselves in danger. You can't do a very good job of reporting when you're dead.
Aside from that, though, did you at any point hold off on any reporting at all because you were concerned about how the United States could look?
No.
But photographer Brent Sanderlin, who traveled with Martz, said at one point someone in the military tried to interfere.
Our company commander got word from a higher-ranking official and said, could you ask these guys to cool it a little bit? He asked them exactly what rules we had broken. He couldn't name any, and so he said, well, they're doing their job then.
CNN's Chris Kramer.
Embedding, I think, though I personally hate the word, worked extremely well under the circumstances. Probably won't be a blueprint for anything else because it worked so well for the media. Had it have been the only way that we covered this particular conflict, it would not have worked, but it wasn't the only way. It was part of a very big jigsaw.
Panelist Richard C. Hotlett, a veteran CBS News correspondent, covered World War II and Vietnam.
To me, one thing that stands out in the coverage of the Iraq War and the aftermath of the war is the amount of time legitimately and profitably devoted to the suffering of the individuals, the civilians in Iraq, also the position that the soldiers are in. It's the job of the reporter to tell them all.
In the Reporters at War documentary, CNN's Chris Kramer complains that some news organizations are xenophobic, jingoistic, and flag-waving. Speaking on our panel, he expressed concern that that kind of journalism could endanger reporters and feed into mistrust of the media.
By and large, the world does not like this profession. There are very large parts of the world that completely loathe this profession. Many parts of the world would like us dead. You know, this particular conflict was the most dangerous and had the worst death toll, certainly since Vietnam, and in the sustained period, it was worse than Vietnam. That's very serious. We should ask ourselves why that may be the case. So what I said in the documentary, which I stand by, is I ask organizations in print and broadcasting here and around the world to ask themselves searching questions about what integrity of journalism means.
Panelist Richard C. Hotlett said the war on terrorism makes a war reporter's job different from anything it's been before.
The casualties here are not only people, but also societies. The reporter is going to be more and more a political analyst and a political observer. The essential is going to be to explain what it is that goes into the war, not just in terms of the mechanics, the soldiers, the bullets, the corpses, but what goes into the war in terms of the political dynamic. And this is going to require people who are highly educated, who have their feet on the ground morally and emotionally, and it's going to require of their bosses a degree of support which we haven't yet begun to measure.
That kind of introspection could be more important than ever as reporters cover this new kind of war that, the panelists said, has no end in sight. I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.